Hello, hello, and welcome to Glycan Hub, the podcast in which we explore health, disease, and longevity through the lens of glycobiology. My name is Rina, and I am your host. Have you ever wondered how come some people who are more advanced in age look younger, while others might appear or feel old for their age? This happens when one's chronological and biological ages do not align. While chronological age steadily increases with the passage of time, the process of biological aging is not fixed and can indeed differ quite substantially among people of the same chronological age. My guest today had a rather unconventional career progression. Starting as an actuary, he now specializes in genomic analysis of complex traits, especially lifespan. Much of his work focuses on exploring how much of our lifespan is actually determined by our genetics and how much by our circumstances and choices. In our conversation, we address some of the questions integral to our current understanding of biological age. For instance, does each of us have a single biological age, or rather a set of biological ages that might relate to different bodily systems? In which case, what does it mean if these different biological ages do not align? We'll discuss the various biomarkers of biological age used today, from DNA methylation to telomere length, IgG glycosylation, all the way to digital biomarkers. My guest is a tenured academic at the University of Edinburgh and the chief scientist for Humanity Health, a company focusing on measuring and improving our rate of aging. A warm welcome to Peter Joshi. Hello and welcome to our podcast.
Hello, Rina.
So what I found very interesting about you is that you started off as an actuary. And so I'm curious, how come you decided to change your career path?
I guess I'd worked in financial services for about 20 years. Career had been very good to me, but I thought it might be nice to try something else before I stopped working. And I could just see that whereas for most of the 20th century, physics and chemistry later had been the coming sciences, that a biology, particularly genomics, seemed to be the coming science of the 21st century. And so decided to find out more about it and get involved, and things grew from there.
And much of your work in recent years has focused on aging. And so, as you said, biology has progressed quite a lot in the last few decades. So I'm curious, how has our understanding of aging changed in recent years?
Biggest thing that I've been involved in has been understanding the genetics of longevity, lifespan, aging. And to an extent, disappointingly, although perhaps happily for society, we discovered really that it's less important than we thought to start with. It looks like lifestyle, both choices in lifestyle and the social situation that you're born into or are living in, are much more relevant to how long people live and how well people age.
Now, yeah, I think it's a very common misconception that, you know, many people think that if we look at the age at which our parents passed away, that is a pretty good indicator of how likely we are to reach an old age. But you're saying that genetics is actually telling a different story.
Yes, and not just the genetics is telling a different story, but, you know, a presumption that if you're born in a long-lived district of your city or country or vice versa, that's, you know, highly determinative of how long you will live. I mean, there is determination in that, I would hasten to add. But at its simplest, if your mother has lived 10 years longer than when she dies, than you might expect, the obvious question as well, an assumption is, well, I could expect to live 10 years longer than everybody else as well. And the short answer to that is no, you could expect to live about 0.8 years longer. Not you personally, obviously, but if we're talking statistically across, you know, 1,000 people or whatever. So longer lived parents do have longer lived children, but the longer lived children are only very slightly longer lived. And that's certainly telling us that it's not a highly genetic trait. I think it's also telling us that personal choices and chance are playing as big a role in how we age and how long we live as much as genetics or the circumstances we're born into.
Now, if I understand, one of your studies really played a pretty big role in our understanding of this, which was the study looking at 1 million lifespans. So could you tell me what was unique about this study in particular?
I think the first answer, the biggest answer to your question, is in the question. Studying 1 million lifespans was a breakthrough at the time. A breakthrough facilitated hugely by UK Biobank, who recruited 500,000 British people into their study, asked them questions about their lifestyle, asked them questions about how long they and their parents had lived, and asked them to donate their blood to give DNA to extract, or to being able to extract DNA. And as a result, researchers like me being able to then study the details of which regions of the genome and which genes at its simplest are affecting how long we live. Principal findings of the study are that a little bit, as I alluded to earlier, there doesn't appear to be any common variation that is making huge differences to how long people live. And in particular, the thing we were obviously looking for is, could we find a gene that was, you know, likely to make you to live to beyond 90? And the short answer to that is no, for two reasons. Firstly, the effect sizes that we discovered of a particular genetic variant being carried by you or me are much smaller than one might have intuitively thought. If carrying a favourable genetic variant in a particular region, in a particular gene, that might lead to you leading 0.1, 0.2, 0.3 years more life than somebody who carries the unfavourable variant. Of course, there's lots of regions of the genome, so you might be really lucky and you might be carrying favourable variants at many, many, many positions in the genome. You'd be extremely lucky to carry favourable variants at, you know, at every position in the genome. That's not happening, but you might have more than your fair share. And that might add a year or two to your life in terms of the sort of research that we were looking at, or what we've been able to find as to specific regions. The second thing that we found really, and here I guess the clinicians might not be overly surprised, the principal things that seem to affect how long people live in terms of genetic variation is whether or not they're carrying a variant that's making them susceptible to disease. We didn't seem to find any variants that were about generalized aging, but instead we were finding variants that were about, say, heart disease, cancer, neurological disease specifically. And each one of those then contributed to, if you're susceptible to a given disease, how long you might expect to live due to that disease, perhaps shortening your lifespan.
Well, the positive thing in that area is that for many of these diseases, lifestyle can actually play a pretty big role in prevention.
Well, exactly. I think if we think of that fact, it's positive for all of us. It does look, and I wouldn't in any sense minimize the role of chance in all of this. Identical twins usually die of different diseases at quite different ages. You know, their environment, their genes clearly identical. Their lifestyle choices obviously vary, but probably are more similar than yours and mine. And yet they die at different ages. And I would attribute much of that due to chance. But certainly, yes, it does look that the lifestyle choices that we make influence the way we age, how we age, when we die. I think the most obvious way to see that is the massive increases in lifespan that we've seen since the 1950s. Lifespan, I'm probably best qualified to talk about in the UK, has increased by 10 to 15 years since the 1950s. That's definitely not been about the changes in genetics, whatever people might think. Changes in genetics happen over millennia at its simplest, maybe slightly shorter than that, but, you know, not 50 years. So it's not been about genes that we've seen any improvements in lifespan. It's been about the overall social environment. And again, credit to the medics, all of the medical discovery and development that we've seen, most obviously antibiotics, most obviously maternal care during childbirth and early infant mortality. But beyond that, we've seen huge improvements in how long people are living. And that's because I think around 50%, one study we did suggested that people are falling prey to disease at 50% lower rates than they used to. And at the same time, their chances of recovery and the length of time that they would live, about half of the improvement in that 10 to, well, to be honest, it was more recent data, but conjecturing about half of the improvement that we've seen in mortality is people are not falling sick so often. And half of it is because when they do fall sick, they recover better because of medical treatment. And perhaps because they're more robust in the first place at, say, age 60, compared with somebody who fell sick in 1970 at age 60.
Now, our conversation today is going to focus on biological aging. And so there's been a rising interest in measuring one's biological age, measuring one's aging rate. So I think maybe a good place to start is by defining what hallmarks of aging are and what is the purpose of measuring them.
Yeah, sure. So the hallmarks of aging are really, there was a paper, Lopez Ota, a few years ago, nearly 10 years ago now, and they proposed that there were, at a cellular level, what they called hallmarks, signals, signs of aging. And they highlighted, from my point of view, a few particularly interesting ones around the genome, in particular, genome instability, the stability of the genome and the way that things are ordered within the genome. Declines with age. A lot of people have been excited for a long time about telomeres and the length of telomeres. People see telomeres as the protective ends of chromosomes. And what we've seen is that that telomeric attrition increases with age. Essentially, those protective caps are wearing out. We see epigenetic alterations. That's to say, your DNA code, while it stays the same over your life, the cage surrounding your DNA code alters, and that's called epigenetics, and we see that altering with age. And then we see other things like cellular senescence, essentially cells going dormant as you age, we see altered intracellular communication again as people age. And these are, I'm not sure how many I mentioned there, but of certainly far from all the hallmarks of aging. But that's the idea, that at a cellular level we can actually see a relationship between age and cellular function. And a lot of research is really focusing on whether or not those alterations in cellular function are part of natural development. Yes, definitely they are. Whether they're a result of damage to the cells and therefore over time they become less functional, less capable. Yes, they are. To what extent is an interesting question for each of those hallmarks. And then again, is there something underlying which is aging that is directly what those hallmarks are measuring? Or are these merely consequences? If it's directly aging, if we can intervene and say increase genome stability, perhaps we could actually see the cells then becoming less aged and recovering other functions. If, on the other hand, it's just a consequence of the aging, that may not be quite so feasible.
But what I find maybe perhaps most interesting about this is that these changes as we age occur at different rates in different people. And there, this is where the idea of biological age comes in. So could you explain what we mean by biological age and what we mean by chronological age as well?
Sure, absolutely. So this has been the focus of quite a lot of my work in recent years. So biological age is a concept that was first proposed by Baker and Sprott is it 50 years ago? Not quite, 1988, if I remember rightly. And maybe it's best to start with a kind of real world example. For any of our listeners who have been to a high school reunion, and I'm sure those who haven't can imagine one, let's imagine this is for people aged 40. You've last seen many of these people when they were aged 18. They're all aged 40 when you arrive, kind of by definition, or give or take, you know, a few months. Their chronological age is 40. So that's what we mean by age normally. But what Baker and Sprott were talking about was some of those people will seem biologically, and if you turn up to the high school reunion, most obviously in terms of physical appearance, different from age 40. Some people will have seemed to have aged very well and perhaps, you know, look not that different from they did at 18, or at least perhaps like other 30-year-olds, and vice versa. Some of those people might look more like 50-year-olds, whether that's their skin texture, their hair colour, their posture, their earlobe size. You may not be familiar, but earlobes grow continuously throughout life. These attributes that you have biologically are indicative of aging. And the interesting question, and the question that Baker and Sprott really asked, was if someone has a biological age of 45, but a chronological age of 40, if that's to be truly meaningful, they should look like someone who is 45 biologically, and therefore, if their intrinsic biology is completely of that of a 45-year-old, that biological age should be more prognostic of health and age-related health and age-related disease and mortality than the chronological age of 40. And so we're coming up with something that is closer to the thing that we're kind of really interested in, which is functionally, what age are you, rather than what the time on the clock says. I suppose we could extend that to your attitude to life as well as your biology, and the two are related, of course, but you know, here we're interested in the sort of cellular biology, the overall functional fitness of each organ and how all of the organs are working together, you know, to give you a healthy life, and extending that. And biological age is the shorthand measure for doing that. I think the other great thing about biological age is that I find people could relate to it. If I tell someone that your relative risk of heart disease is 1.3, all they get is more questions. Well, is that good or bad? Well, it's bad. It's 1.3 times that of somebody else, so you're more prone to heart disease than someone else. Is it really bad? No. You know, there is a range of these things amongst everyone. And so on and so on and so on. And then, for example, 1.3 times what? What is my risk of heart disease? People just don't know. Whereas if I say to someone, your heart age appears to be 45, but you're 40, I think we can quickly relate to, well, yeah, that sounds bad. It's not the end of the world that it's 45. There's plenty of 45-year-olds who don't have heart attacks in the next 6 months, and so on and so on. But it'd be great to get it back down to 40 or below. And so it's got this scientific notion, on the one hand, of functional age, but then I think a very relatable meaning to people who, you know, are not used to looking at public health statistics and relative risks and all of the things that that we look at in public health.
We have touched upon a bit earlier on the impact of diseases on the rate of aging. So could you tell us what age-related diseases are and how they impact our aging?
So at its simplest, age-related diseases are diseases whose incidence increases with age. So probably know, I'm sure most of your listeners are aware, there are a set of developmental diseases that occur very early in life. Those are not the ones that I'm thinking about. it's diseases like cancer, like heart disease, where we see a much bigger risk of that disease to somebody who's in their 60s than somebody who's in their 30s. So that's an age-related disease. Other ones are Alzheimer's disease and dementia more generally. It's important to recognise, as again it says in the question, it's age-related. I'm not saying that age is the only cause, or that if you're in your 30s that you can't suffer these diseases, but your risk of suffering from these diseases increases substantially with age. And what we're trying to understand is, can we develop measures of biological age in which we find are even more prognostic of these disease outcomes than simple chronological age like we were just talking about.
Now your work, your research, focuses on multi-omic analysis of aging traits. Could you explain what that means?
Yeah, sadly the answer isn't in the question this time. I'm going to need to do the hard work. So we really need to start off with a omic, I think. So as I was saying earlier, I see that medical science and biology progress is just accelerating at a huge pace at the moment. And one of the reasons for that is that we're now able to measure many, many things. And by many things, I don't mean simply what might first come to mind, that we can measure height and weight and blood sugar level and. What we can measure, for example, is fat in your blood. But instead of just measuring, as people who have been for these tests will be familiar, LDL cholesterol, HDL cholesterol, we can measure very, very specific fractions of specific types of fat in your blood. And so we can measure hundreds of different blood fats separately. And that would be a lipidomic analysis, a many lipid analysis. Okay, lipid being fat, sorry. And so that is an omic. So we have lipidomics. There are thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of proteins in our bodies. We can measure the relative amounts of all of those proteins. That's proteomics. We can measure immune function on different levels, and so on and so on. The whole omic field, in a way, has really been kicked wide open by genomics, which is where I started. And genomics, instead of what would have happened in the 1980s, 1990s, where you would measure someone's genetic status at one particular region of the genome, instead you're going to measure somebody's genetic status at millions of regions of the genome. So you've got millions of measures of their DNA. That's the genome, and genomics is the measurement of those things. So, sorry, a long answer, but so that's omics. Multi-omics is then saying, well, actually, we don't just measure many, many types of protein or many, many types of blood lipid. We could do both at the same time. We could measure your genes at the same time as well. And then that would be a multi-omic analysis. So on each dimension, we've got hundreds, thousands of measures, and then we've got multiple dimensions. And to try to integrate that into one analysis, to try to understand whether those different dimensions are measuring the same thing or something different in aggregate, and to understand if we have different measures coming out of each of these different types of measurement, how we can then best integrate that into sort of one meaningful whole, most obviously biological age, but it could be something else that one's measuring as well.
And how long has this area of multiomics existed?
Well, as I suggested, I think really the whole thing has kicked off in the last 15 years with the ability to make the real transformation is actually a very practical one. it's the cost of doing these things. One could have, in many cases, done these things in the 1980s or 1990s, but it would have just cost so much. But with improvements in our technologies, we're able to measure these things. And I think it's really kicked off in the last 15 years in terms of single omics. So looking at proteins, for example, and much of that is being enabled by genomic technology that then has been translatable into different fields, and not always. And then looking at many, many omics together, that's really very new. It's still expensive to gather this data. It's also, certainly for the work that I do, important to gather this data, not just for one person, but for thousands of people. The study that we used to do the work that we've been alluding to is called the ORCID study, very fantastic study run by a former colleague of mine, Professor Jim Wilson at the University of Edinburgh. And he gathered this sort of information for 1,000 people in many, many dimensions. And we've been able to do what I would have to confess is probably, in a sense, pilot work as to where this might go. Probably need the ORCID study or another study to become even bigger than we have already in terms of the number of participants before we can draw the strength of conclusions we'd like to. But it's a new field and it's going to get bigger.
Oh, it's absolutely exciting to hear about it. Another very interesting study of yours focused on comparison of different omics biological aging clocks. So to start off, could you say what are biological aging clocks and what were the clocks you used in the study measuring?
So it's quite a lot to unpack there. So biological age, I hope we've got a sense of already. There's essentially two ways that you might think about going about building a mathematical model at its simplest to estimate biological age. The first would be to look at outcomes. So I think the most obvious outcome is just human mortality, death. So let's build a predictor of death. So it sounds a bit like the Grim Reaper, but you know, let's. And as an actuary, I guess I was used to doing this many, many years ago. Actuaries found that sex, age, lifestyle, smoking, alcohol consumption were predictive of death. And often actually, literally in the actuarial tables, we would have the typical person assessed. And then we would say, oh, well, if somebody smokes, their age appears to be 7 years above that of somebody who doesn't smoke. And therefore, if this person's age 40, their mortality looks like a 47-year-old. And that feels a bit like what we talked about biological age already. But it's outcome focused. The alternative is to think of measuring things like earlobe size, and simply seeing how it relates to chronological age, cholesterol level, blood pressure, epigenetics we've alluded to earlier, but the structure of your DNA, the structure of various other things within your blood, how does that relate to age? And so we would call those aging clocks, and in particular, those are aging clocks trained by chronological age. So what we're doing is looking at a large population and seeing essentially something rather useless. Can we predict chronological age based on these measures and use, to get a little bit technical, chronological age to teach us how to make those predictions and then go to a new population and try and make them again? And the short answer to that is yes. At its simplest, it's probably of more forensic interest than taken to extreme than biological interest. Can we, from a drop of blood and no other information, tell what sex you are? Yes, I think that's no surprise to anybody nowadays. We can also tell who your mum and dad are. Again, no surprise to anybody. If we have their blood as well, of course. But finally, a bit more of a surprise, we can tell what age you are to a degree of accuracy. And the study was really trying to understand how accurately we can predict biological age from the different types of omics we've just been describing. And then importantly, we went on to try and understand if your blood protein levels are predictive of chronological age in this way, what about your blood lipid levels, your blood fat levels? Are they predictive in the same way? We didn't study your lobe length, but had we? Would it have been predictive in the same length? And that essentially is what we did in this study. And the short answer is that different things are got different capacity to predict chronological age. Some of them can predict it very accurately indeed. We're talking about plus or minus 2 years for somebody in their 40s or 50s, just based on their blood. As I say, one could imagine that. I've not seen an application yet, but one could imagine some application in a forensic context of that sort of technology. What we also discovered is that there was a degree of overlap and a degree of difference between the different measures and trying to understand exactly how they all fit together. And then probably most interesting for those of us who are fascinated by biological age, to what extent those age predictions that we're making from your body are predictive of health over and above the chronological age. And again, we did see some associations there. That's the nub of the study. Study was probably too small to say anything too categorically about the health prediction. We could say a lot about our capacity to predict chronological age. Predict's a funny word in that context, I know, but I think you'll all know what I mean.
If I'm not wrong, you measured 11 different biological aging clocks. And so both when constructing and when measuring with these clocks, how can you know which ones are measuring something that's actually meaningful compared to those who might be less accurate?
The first meaningfulness is simply, is that particular clock predictive of a chronological age? And if it is, then it's meaningful in that sense. And so, for example, we also looked at just body shape. You can make some fairly sophisticated X-ray style scans of people's bodies and see essentially where the different muscles and fat compartments are. Well, I mean, they're always in the same place, but what size they are relative to each other. How predictive of that is that of age? Not very predictive, we found, even with quite a lot of measurements. On the other hand, if we look at protein levels or these epigenetics, the structure of your DNA, structure is not quite the right word, but I don't want to get too technical with the audience, but properties of your DNA more than its code, are highly predictive potentially of chronological age. So that was the first thing. But then what we found, for example, there's an attribute of your cells called glycans that relate to your immune system. We found glycans were not particularly helpful in predicting chronological age. They perform medium amongst the spectrum of 11 that you recognize, Rena. But what we did see, perhaps not surprisingly, but very optimistically, was that glycan age was predictive of health outcomes. Not surprisingly, perhaps, because it is to do with your immune system. And we were looking at both of these facets. And as I suggest, actually, the more interesting biological ages, at least it seems to me, are the biological ages that relate to not just being able to predict chronological age, although that has some technical interest in terms of understanding aging processes, but the ones that are then actually more predictive of a health as well.
So we've said you had 11 different biological aging clocks. each of which was used to measure biological age. What happens when you put all of that data together into one big aging clock?
That's a good question. So that was one of the things that we did. We said, well, as I was saying earlier in the conversation, you know, effectively we measured 11 different dimensions of these omic attributes of your body and hundreds of measures within those. What we then did was we went on to think about, well, what happens if we put all of that into what we called a mega omic analysis? And perhaps not surprisingly, given that each of them was quite predictive of chronological age in the sense that we've been discussing, when we put them all together, we get something extremely predictive of chronological age. And so, again, in the forensic context I was talking about, if for some reason someone didn't know or refused to tell us their age, we might be able to infer their age using these sort of techniques. Inevitably, if we can predict someone's chronological age exactly and do that, it doesn't tell us much about their biological age as distinct from their chronological age, because all we've got is a chronological age recapitulated. So we found it's possible, but its helpfulness to a clinician in the clinic, where the person's probably telling them accurately what their age is, and if they're sceptical, they can look up their health record or their birth certificate. It's on the face of it going to be less useful.
Now, when thinking conceptually about biological age, you pose a very interesting question in the paper, and I have it here. So it said, the notion of biological age raises fundamental questions. Is there one biological age for a person, or a set of biological ages, perhaps relating to different bodily systems? And so I'm wondering if indeed there are different biological ages which relate to different bodily systems. Might we overlook potential health risks which exist outside the confines of the body system to which a particular biological age clock is receptive to?
Yeah, exactly. So I think research, to be honest, is limited in this context, and this is why we raise it as a question. But the notion, I think, is intuitive and certainly does merit further research. Is there a difference between brain age, heart age, liver age, kidney age for an individual? And is your single biological age that we've been trying to measure essentially the composite of all of these things? A composite perhaps weighted by the relative importance. In the end of the day, of course, all organs are probably, or all those organs at least, are crucial to life. And therefore, a failure of one is a big deal, even if the others are healthy. But that's the notion that we're trying to raise. I'm a great believer in it as a way of trying to disentangle this rather more complicated or composite biological age that we've been discussing so far. And I think also disentangling any one of those ages between the effect of your genes, the effect of your current chronological age, the effect of your genes, the effect of your social environment that's possibly somewhat beyond your, or to a great extent beyond your control, and then your individual life and choices within that social environment. And therefore seeing, it's going to become quite a big table, and to show it to patients and customers, we need to make it simpler than that. But I think that sort of notion underpinning a single measure of biological age, and therefore at its simplest being able to say, well, actually, it looks like you're doing really well on most of these things, but you need to target this organ system. Perhaps most obviously if it was your liver drinking less, but you know, no doubt there's, you know, other organ system, well, there are other organ systems and other interventions in that context that could be focused. And in a way, that's not that different from what medics do at the moment. But the hope would be perhaps if we can measure these ages before the disease emerges, that we can prescribe interventions earlier and earlier, hopefully interventions without side effects like exercising more, drinking less, and so on and so on, but really motivate people to do those and do it in a targeted way that reflects their susceptibilities and their lifestyles.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the prognostic potentials of biological ages certainly sounds very inviting. You are currently working as the Chief Scientific Officer at Humanity Health, which is a company that has developed an app allowing the users to measure the rate of biological age through digital biomarkers. Could you explain what digital biomarkers are and how do they compare to the ones which we just talked about?
Absolutely, delighted to. So yes, that's exactly what we're doing at Humanity. We're measuring people's biological age. We're measuring their rate of aging, which we'll maybe get to in a moment. And I think as crucially, we're then talking to people about how to adapt their lifestyle to improve their biological age. Digital biomarkers, well, at its simplest, most of us nowadays have a mobile phone. Can we use the mobile phone and the digital watch to measure biological age in the way that I've been talking about through omics? In that context, particularly, we do other measures of biological age, like blood profile biological age and like epigenetic age at Humanity as well. But we're very much focused on these digital biomarkers, essentially arising from movement patterns and heart rate patterns in the context of those movement patterns, to understand someone's biological age or to estimate someone's biological age. And the surprising thing is that one of our partners showed that the biological age measure that we're coming up through with digital biomarkers is as accurate as that can be maintained from blood profiles. So that listeners who have had their blood taken and had their doctor come up with a generalized blood profile of HDL cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, and the various other things that come up in those profiles, we find that using the UK Biobank study that we talked about earlier, that where people did do these digital biomarkers as well as the conventional blood biomarkers, that the digital biomarkers were giving us just as good biological ages as the blood biomarkers. And there's a few benefits to that. The first and most obvious one is back to my highlighting the strength of the study that we did into genetics with a million lifespans. Digital biomarkers are easier to gather, easier to gather both as a customer and as a researcher, and so we've got a lot more volume of data. But also, those digital biomarkers are potentially available, well, realistically from our point of view, daily, but hourly in principle, minute by minute, arguably. But for our useful point of view, daily measures that we then make into a composite measure over weeks. And it's easy just to gather them continuously at volume. And then if we see changes in those markers, they become apparent without, for example, having to visit your physician. Scott, sorry. But also for me as a researcher, I'm able to see the particular effects for particular customers of a changes in actions on changes in those biological ages.
And what is the benefit of being able to measure the rate of biological aging?
If we can capture biological age, it sort of works at two levels. One, we're going to be able to advise people individually of their biological age. Secondly, what we see going forward is that what we're going to be able to say to someone with certain characteristics of age, weight, sex, and so on, your biological age seems to be better or worse than it should be based on your date of birth, on the one hand. But secondly, what we've learned from people like you is that this particular intervention seems particularly effective. So please try to do an extra 3,000 steps going forward, or please try to have a longer period between meals than you're having at the moment, or snack less. And that recommendation will have two strengths. One is that it will be effective for the person, but secondly, we're hoping and expecting that we'll be able to come up with recommendations that are practical for the individual. And again, practical not just for people generally, but practical for people like them.
Yeah, I think one of the main strengths is being able to develop a program or a system which gives tailored advice to each individual. So as I understand, you've had a pretty mathematical approach in designing that program.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it's the recommendations that our system comes up with at the moment were based on a deep review of the scientific literature as to what seems to help and not help. I'm sure listeners regularly read in the newspapers about the beneficial effects of, or not, of caffeine, of bacon, exercise and so on. Well, what we did was take lots of scientific literature and look at the evidence in conjunction. Sleep's another one, for example, that we see beneficial effects of sleep and sleeping the right amount. But going forward, as I say, because we see the biological age for our customers and we see the actions that they've taken, we're joining the effect of those actions in recent months to the effect of the change in biological age in recent months, and concluding actually, where the scientific literature is robust, being borne out in our data or not, and therefore adjusting for our customers, both as a whole and individually, the sort of recommendations that we make as to how to reduce their biological age.
Now we've talked about just previously about the prognostic potentials of using biological aging clocks in a clinical setting. And I think what really has to be taken into consideration is that these clocks really need to become more practical and more easily accessible. So what do you think are some milestones we have to pass before these clocks can actually become clinically useful?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good question. The fact is, at the moment, to my knowledge, they're not being used in the clinic. Conventional diagnostics tests and conventional prognostic tests are being used in the clinic. I'd say on the one hand, we need to improve the clocks. But on the other hand, I think I might argue that when your doctor looks at your BMI, your blood pressure and your cholesterol ratios and says, you're red, green or amber, it's actually a presentational thing. That could be, in the way that we discussed earlier, presented as a biological age, that your heart age appears, you're 40, your heart age appears to be 50, you need to do something about it. And anybody who's more than, 3 years different from their chronological age, that's something that the doctor remarks upon, and if it's adverse, says we need to do something about it. And that in itself is quite translatable. I'm very conscious that the medical profession is quite conservative, and they probably feel they have a mechanism at the moment that works quite well, and would be reluctant to change it. I'd question that slightly when you see these tables when you're sitting with your doctor and it's got percentages in it. As an actuary, I'm not too fazed by that, but I think many people are kind of left with doubts as to what that percentage means, and therefore unsure what to do about it. And in a way, therefore, what I'm saying is that coming up with a readily usable measure of biological age that's communicated well would be one way to take forward clinical practice. And then the other obvious way to someone like me, who spends their time researching how to make better biological clocks, is to come up with something that is more accurate than the existing tests. And therefore, Well, you know, once proven and once communicated well to the community, be the natural thing that people will want to use as opposed to some of the existing tests that are out there.
I think also one question I'm thinking of is that with all of these tests, you've mentioned a lot of them take into consideration a very wide number of biomarkers. So when thinking about, again, making them clinically useful, do you think their reliability and accuracy decreases with a decrease in the number of biomarkers?
That's a really good question. The second part of the question had a premise that actually wasn't borne out by our research. What we found, what my student Erin McDonald Dunlop found, was that she could identify a substantial, maybe that's sorry, it's wrong, a much smaller set of biomarkers than the thousands that we'd been using, and that was equally prognostic of biological age as the larger set. And therefore, it does look to us like once we can get large enough data sets that we can make good predictions. And the problem essentially is, you know, if we want to predict heart disease, sadly, we need our study participants or many of our study participants to have had heart disease. That takes time and it takes numbers. So over time, we will be able to gather these information. And then what I'm saying is at that point, having built a good predictor, maybe using 1,000 predictors, we would expect to be able to reduce that to perhaps 12. And then, as you allude to, the cost, the feasibility, the speed at which a lab could do that test and return it to the doctor becomes practical in terms of clinical timescales.
That's certainly very encouraging to hear. So you have mentioned that our lifespan has increased over the last 50 years, expected lifespan. But when it comes to these rare communities, such as Ikaria in Greece or Okinawa in Japan, which consistently continue to have longer lifespans than what we observe in general. Is there something specific about their lifestyle, their surroundings, that allows them to enter into such old age? And probably more importantly, is it something that we can learn from and replicate in our life?
I don't know where to start there. The short answer is, I feel I don't know. I know quite a lot of people think they do know, but my suspicion is that there is just so many differences between those communities and other communities that pinpointing which of them is the important difference is very difficult. I am reasonably convinced that it's not genetics. Some of these communities have been quite isolated in the past and therefore may have significant genetic differences, but my gut feeling is still that that's not a major part of the explanation. And the problem is, you know, if we're to take the difference between, say, France and the UK, and the difference in expected lifespan between the France and the UK, which isn't that much, to be fair. Which of the multitude of differences between France and the UK are we going to take? And even if we studied everybody in France together and then compared that with everybody in the UK together, I think we would struggle. And therefore, what we've tended to do is look within populations like the UK and UK Biobank, and try to essentially, it's a bit more sophisticated than this, determine people with a single difference between them and which one of those is living longer, and then do that thousands of times and use that as the way to find out. That's not to deny the other part of the premise of your question, which is that there is some secret sauce, secret, sadly, to the people that are there as well as the rest of us, as to why these people are living longer. But it's just very, very difficult to say why those people are living longer than people, say, in another part of Italy or Japan, because there are so many differences. And the hints I get at the moment are, it's the things you'd expect. It's diet, it's lifestyle, it's social support, it's the socioeconomic situation more generally.
Now we've talked about age-related diseases and use of biological age to potentially improve our health and optimally to improve, to decrease the rate at which we age and potentially also increase our lifespans. So what would you think would be some of the most obvious social, societal and economic impacts of slowing the rate of aging?
There's whole industries, most obviously the cosmetic industries, you know, that are targeting slowing the appearance of aging at very least. It's something that people want. So I think it's going to be a product, a set of behaviours with huge demand from society. I think your question is trying to go a bit deeper than that. I think the intrinsic benefit is, you know, Baker and Sprott's biological age was all about functionality. We see so much function, not all function, decline with age. Cognition does, not decline until really quite late in life. But more generally, people able to be more economically productive on the one hand, but more importantly, I think, have better health and do things that they want to do that age might otherwise have been standing in the way of. And if we can slow down aging, if we can slow down particular attributes of biological aging, we'll have all of those benefits. And hopefully, less need for treatments, less need for medications and so on and so on. And if done well, I'd very much like to think people not just living longer lives, but happier lives.
And lastly, my question really has to do with your view of what you think should be done to extend this field in the future. What do you think are the biggest kind of directions that research should take in this area?
The sort of research that I've been very involved in until recently, as I say, getting those 1,000 people in Orkney, they're already trying to expand that study. And there are more than 1,000 people in the study, many more than 1,000 people in the study now, but not always the money to measure the many, many things that we've measured for the 1,000 people. We're measuring quite a lot for the others, but you know, at its simplest, more funding to expand those studies and come to firm conclusions and drill down into levels of details within those conclusions. I'm a strong advocate of the digital biomarkers that we were talking about. I think more surveying of digital biomarkers and health outcomes than the way that UK Biobank has done over time. That's naturally coming with UK Biobank, for example, so it is going to get better and better. And then I think, to the extent genetics has succeeded in this, but it's not succeeded as much as we hoped, trying to understand the biological mechanisms that are going on. So where we're measuring biologies, whether it's blood proteins or whatever, and we're seeing that affect aging and disease outcomes, trying to understand the biological pathway down which that acts, and then build interventions along that pathway. That's a classic method of drug discovery and drug treatment. But, you know, how are lifestyle interventions? You've talked about these exceptionally long-lived communities around the world. What is going on there? What could we replicate in our society that would give us those benefits? That, I think, in the end, may well be about as much understanding the biology as simply saying, well, it's that particular intervention.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Peter.
Thank you, Rina. It's great to talk to you.
Now, speaking to our listeners, I hope you gained a better insight into our current understanding of biological age, as well as its practical applications in preventative medicine. If you would like to access more information about this conversation, Peter's research and Humanity Health, follow the link in the description to the show notes for this episode. Equally, if you would like to find out more about Glycan Age, head on to glycanage.com, where you can access a whole list of our scientific publications, blog posts, testimonials, and of course, this is where you can order your Glycan Age test kit. Watch out for our next episode, where I will be joined by Hudson Fries, a glycobiologist and biochemist whose research focuses on congenital disorders of glycosylation. We will be discussing the role of glycans in normal physiological function and the consequences of glycosylation defects. Please don't forget to leave ratings and reviews for this episode and engage with us on social media. Thank you for listening and have a great day.